Hello, friends. This is the Environment Show, and welcome. As the 1990-91 academic year gets underway on campuses of colleges and universities across the nation, students electing an earth science course, and increasing numbers are, likely will purchase a new textbook by Dr. Bernard Nebel. We'll talk to the professor author. Also, Power Kinetics, a small solar collector manufacturing firm struggling against low oil prices the past decade, is ready to heat up now that oil prices are going up. Company President Bill Rogers is excited and confident.
Hell, you've shown people in any number of situations that it's worked in the hands of customers, and so that those customers say, yeah, I've had one of these for 5 years, I have no problem with it. It's this more reliable than my gas supplier. You know, when people can say that type of thing, you'll see a lot of solar everywhere.
Those stories this time on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. It's made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Aerial spraying of the pesticide malathion over several sections of Los Angeles has been suspended temporarily while city officials battle with county and state authorities. As Joy Newell reports, one city councilman has charged that the state is using citizens as guinea pigs in the fight against the medfly.
The medfly is seen as a major threat to California agriculture, and agriculture is probably still the state's major industry. But Los Angeles City Councilman Joel Wax says alternates to aerial spraying, like baited traps and or ground spraying, would have been preferable to having helicopters spraying over urban areas during the past year or more. Wax maintains the state is literally flying blind in terms of health effects to those living in the sprayed areas. Sarah Hawthorne is one of them. Hawthorne testified at a city hall hearing about skin irritations, itching, loss of appetite, and nervousness.
Have you been sprayed during the state's recent malathion campaign?
Yes, I have been sprayed. I've been awoke at 3:15 one morning. No, I never heard anything on TV. Usually sometimes they will tell you. But this one time I hear these helicopters droning and going over the house where I live and spraying this poison. And it was horrible. It really was. Something's got to be done. I believe that somebody is being paid off big money to continue this spraying. I really do. Big politicians, and somehow they've got to be stopped. They really do.
Hawthorne was one of several citizens who have testified at City Hall hearings on the malathion spraying. There were several physicians, too. Alfred Sadoun, for instance. He's a professor of neurologic ophthalmology at the University of Southern California. Sadoun told the council that members of the California Malathion Public Health Effects Advisory Committee had misstated his testimony on more than one occasion, and that he had had to fight to get the minutes of several meetings changed to accurately reflect his position of concern as it pertains to damage of optic nerves from exposure to malathion. Dr. Sadoun referred several times to studies done in Japan after pesticide spraying there, which included malathion. The definitive medical studies after several cases of permanent blindness in Japan were done by a Dr. Ishikawa, and Dr. Sadoun says California state health officials are setting up an animal study which is crude compared to Ishikawa's.
They'll be performed on rats who have extra enzymes that humans don't have that would destroy the malathion. They would give the rats the malathion by mouth, which would give their liver a chance to detoxify it before it gets into their system, unlike the situation with humans. And they would examine the rats' visual systems in extremely crude ways that wouldn't pick up anything short of total blindness. It's interesting that they would choose to do such a study when they have been the ones that have suggested that Dr. Ishikawa's work is substandard, when in fact his animal studies using dogs and his electromicroscopic counts of the nerves are exactly the sort of experimental design we need.
At the second of the hearings, Dr. Paul Papanek, head of the Los Angeles County Health Department Toxics Program, testified under threat of subpoena after declining to appear at the first of the hearings. Councilman Wax gives his opinion of the Papanek testimony.
I think what he's done is he has just confirmed our opinion and our position all along that what they have been doing is using people as guinea pigs.
What we have always suspected, what we have been most critical of, is really confirmed by his testimony, and that is the fact that they have sprayed first and they are studying later, that they haven't really done the studies that they need to do to make a determination that it's safe, that their assurances, their constant assurances, that don't worry, we've studied this constantly over and over and everything is fine, doesn't really hold up. And in fact, they are just beginning, as a result of all the public protest, as a result of our lawsuit, now beginning to develop the kinds of tests that one needs to begin assessing the real health impacts of malathion.
Your lawsuit seeks alternative methods of fighting the medfly. What's the status of the lawsuit?
We're seeking an order from the court prohibiting the resumption of the spraying of malathion unless and until the state does an independent health risk assessment, which they've yet to do, which has to be done, showing that there's no serious potential adverse health impacts from malathion, and also requiring the state to have a new risk management study, a pesticide control program, which uses the many alternatives that exist there.
Wax says if the agriculture sector is so concerned about the medfly, they should be the ones footing the bill for taking care of it.
One of the problems that we've had is that the reliance upon the aerial spraying of malathion, which now costs the local taxpayers approximately $44 million just for this year's spraying program alone, is in fact being borne completely by the taxpayers. Whereas many of the alternatives that would similarly protect the industry would be alternatives that the industry themselves would have to pay for.
Wax says the most disturbing part is hearing from people who report various health effects after the sprayings.
We have received well over 1,000 already. They can't all be coincidental. They came totally unsolicited. So it indicates that they're just the tip of the iceberg. We called the first 300 back. We found from those first 300 that less than 15% ever contacted the health department. They either had no idea who or where to call or that they should call or they thought that it wouldn't make any difference. If only one out of seven even bothered to call them, if they themselves have now admitted they've received over 2,000 calls, we're talking about at least 14,000 to 15,000 people who have illnesses attributed to malathion spraying. How many people have to get sick before you stop, before you change your program? How many cases of miscarriage do there have to be? How many people have to have respiratory problems? Everything that they have said has turned out not to be true. Every study that they have relied upon, they didn't expect that we would read and analyze. In fact, all of the studies that the state have are either incomplete, outdated, or in many cases refuted by their own authors and researchers themselves.
County and state officials maintain they are now in the process of assessing urine tests and tests on asthmatics in spray areas. Meanwhile, the fruit-hungry medfly and the aerial spraying of malathion to combat it remain a potent story, with all the elements of high drama: people's health, big business, government guidelines, and pesticides, an ongoing environmental issue. I'm Joy Newell for the Environment Show in Los Angeles.
Joy Newell reports from member station KCRW. For many students back on colleges and university campuses now, a course in environmental science may be either a requirement or an elective. Dan Brody talked to Dr. Bernard Neville, the author of a new environmental science textbook, about the book and about the rapidly changing field of environmental sciences.
Dr. Bernard Neville, a professor at Catonsville Community College near Baltimore, Maryland, has recently released a new edition of his textbook on environmental science. This is the third edition of the book in just 10 years. Neville says his interest in developing environmental science as a discipline, separate from the other hard sciences, first came in the 60s, when the first environmental movement began.
It became evident that people had a very poor understanding of where the environmental problems were coming from and what might be done to solve them. And obviously that wasn't leading to very effective solutions. So as I stepped into my first teaching position in the early 70s, it struck me that here we were offering the traditional specialized courses, geology, people were really the screaming need was the ability to understand the environmental problems and what needed to be done about them. And that began my teaching we didn't call it environmental science at the time, that wasn't invented yet. But gradually I started teaching about these issues, and there were no textbooks available, so I set about writing up my notes to give students that aid, and then when I got that far, I decided I could make these more readily available, and I gradually evolved into writing the text.
But what exactly does one learn in an environmental science course?
Well, ecology is the basis of understanding the natural ecosystems and how they function. That is how plants and animals function together to make an ongoing, sustainable, natural living system.
As an example from his course, Nebel discussed the problem of population. He said that even within his lifetime, such immense population changes have occurred that the world is almost already at a non-sustainable level.
We realize that during my lifetime, the population has tripled. I was born in 1934, and the population then was 2 billion, and now it's pushing 6 billion. This kind of population increase is simply not sustainable. Similarly, in the area of waste disposal, we have the practice of just disposing of waste into water and air, and obviously the pollution problems are getting such that they're intolerable. This kind of waste disposal is not sustainable. The third area is energy consumption. There's no way we can, the resources will sustain the use of energy, nor sustain the pollutant byproducts of the energy. So what can we do to make our society sustainable? Any of these three areas can bring it to a crash within the next 40 years unless something's done about it. Principles for sustainability are found in natural ecosystems, how they function and work, how natural systems, the different species work together and are sustainable over thousands, millions of years.
Nebel's book and the many courses which will use the text are aimed at both teaching the students about the problems that exist and about their solutions, or at least the possible ways to reach solutions. But where do the students go with the information after they get out of school?
In terms of careers, people going into environmental studies, unless they're going to be a teacher like myself, need to specialize and go into some particular area. But any occupation can have an environmental side to it, right from your position of radio and TV journalism. You're emphasizing environmental issues, and I think that's very important to convey these issues to the public. In business, I mean, you can have an environmentally responsive, sensitive business, or you can be environmentally destructive, and I think so it's important for any business person to understand environmental issues. But it's important for all citizens to have an environmental understanding, I think, and use this understanding in their day-to-day lifestyles, certainly at the voting booth, because unless we really begin to come to terms with these, we're not going to have a life as we know it in another, well, I think it's as close as 40 years, you know, that these issues are coming to a head now. Unless we solve them over the next 40 years, we're going to see drastic consequences.
In the introduction to your book, you quote a Chinese proverb, if you're not getting what you want, change what you're doing. I thought that was a great addition to the introduction. And then you ask, is it possible to change, to make the changes that we need to? And I put that to you. Is it possible?
Well, you know, I like to use the analogy when I'm asked that question of you're out in a lifeboat. Your ship has gone down, and from the information you have, you know that there's land 50 miles away. You also know that there's a hurricane coming up within the next 24, 36 hours. And you sit around there debating, can you do it or do you start rowing? You know, I think we have to just start rowing. And I think when you look at the thousands of people involved, the hundreds of organizations, the nucleus, and everything is there. That people are becoming more and more aware, and we see changes it is just a matter of the public recognizing that, yes, this is serious enough and we start need to do it.
Nebel says that in his own experiences as a teacher, students are starting to recognize the importance of environmental science. But not everybody, he says, is so responsive.
Well, I confess I'm a little bit manic depressive. You know, I look at things happening and I'm manic, but then I see a lot of inertia and foot dragging and ignoring and denying the consequences, and that's the downside. But I think it's I think we all have to just do what we can, and we have to change what we can, which is ourselves, and then just hope that other people look at this and come along too.
For the most part, people are starting to come along. More and more schools are offering courses in environmental science, and more students are signing up. So hopefully within their lifetime, new books will be written which are able to focus more on the solutions than the problems. For the Environment Show, this is Dan Brody.
Dr. Bernard Nebel teaches in the Department of Biology at Catonsville Community College in Maryland. His textbook, Environmental Science, The Way the World Works, is now in its third edition, published by Prentice Hall of Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey. Our thanks to Dan Brody for that report. Dan, who has been interning for the Environment Show for the summer, is heading out on his own now. His work has been much appreciated. His presence will be much missed. Thanks, Dan, and good luck. Here's a poem.
The Pasture by Robert Frost. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too.
The Pasture by Robert Frost, from A Pocketbook of Robert Frost, published by Washington Square Press, Incorporated, New York, New York. Read by Sheldon Rothberg, poet and teacher at Berkshire Community College in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. We have burned up 75 to 80% of the known oil reserves in this country. What remains ought to be used to develop the energies of the future. That's what Bill Rogers says. Rogers is president of Power Kinetics Incorporated, based in Troy, New York. The small upstate New York firm has been in the business of designing and building solar collectors now for well over a decade. But up until recently, oil has been so cheap that neither funding nor general interest has been in place to support his technology. Now, though, things may be starting to happen, and fast. Much of the criticism leveled at so-called alternative energy sources is that no matter what the source, it is not considered reliable. There are always drawbacks. One of the problems with most solar collectors, the kind that homeowners and small businesses have installed, is that there is tremendous heat loss. A lot of metal piping is exposed to air cooling. Rogers' technology, though, is based on mirrors and a structure in appearance much like a satellite receiving dish.
The collector is quite large. It's typically 7 stories tall, where the receiver is 7 stories off the ground. And we found that by orienting it so that it rotates about an axis that's exactly parallel to the Earth's axis, by turning exactly one revolution a day, it follows the sun without any trouble or any, you don't need a fancy computer to make it work, although we do use one. By doing that, you maximize the amount of sun you collect in the day and minimize the amount of effort it takes to do that. And we use 392 quite large mirrors, which are roughly 2 feet by 4 feet in dimensions. And they reflect all the energy that's incident on them into a small hole that's 30 inches in diameter. Inside the hole are 800 feet of high tensile steel pipe, which we circulate water, which in there turns to steam, and that steam then is taken down to a steam engine and it's turned into electricity. in a reciprocating steam engine.
Another problem with any energy system is that it takes energy to make energy, much like money invested in the stock market in order to make a profit. Evaluating the practicality of any energy system necessarily must take into consideration how much energy is put in before you get some out. Rogers feels very optimistic about his system. In fact, using solar photovoltaic cells, the collector could, in a sense, run itself.
We're very careful in designing the equipment so that we balance the equipment so it takes almost no power to drive it throughout a day or a year. And one of these very large solar collectors, which weighs 20 tons, takes 1 kilowatt hour per day to make it do all its things throughout the day, which here costs about 6 cents a day. But if you were to do it on the collector with photovoltaic panels, you'd need a very small photovoltaic panel or a battery run off the electric power generating station, and you'd probably use a hundredth of 1% of the energy you actually produce to make itself run.
Now, the bottom line. How much energy could the collectors generate, and how reliable is that energy? Says Rogers, it all depends on the sun.
As long as the sun is out, the system is very viable. The science and engineering of it is still very much in its infant stage. We've made two major electric power generation stations to date, and we'll need to make many dozens more before it becomes a real commodity for the industrial market. You know, until you've shown people in any number of situations that it's worked in the hands of customers, and so that those customers say, yeah, I've had one of these for 5 years, I have no problem with it. It's this more reliable than my gas supplier. You know, when people can say that type of thing, you'll see a lot of solar everywhere.
Because this technology is best suited for working at high temperatures, 1,000 degrees centigrade, to generate steam, Power Kinetics solar collector is not very useful for residential use, at least not at the present time, though with rapidly developing technologies, Rogers says this could and likely will change in the near future. For now, the prime uses are on the industrial level. In fact, the industrial level in developing nations that do not have large investments or skills in oil, coal, natural gas, or nuclear production. The solar energy industry has not had an easy time of it getting accepted. For one thing, critics point out, the technology is just too expensive to be practical. But, says Rogers, while the initial costs may be discouraging, in the long run, the figures come more into line.
The cost of the solar equipment, including the electric power generating plant, is about $1.80 a watt. Or for a kilowatt, it would be $1,800. A typical coal plant is about $1,200. A gas plant is about $800 per kilowatt. A nuclear plant is much more than this. They're about $2 to $2.50 a watt, or $2,500 a kilowatt. The difference is that there's no fuel costs involved with that. So depending on what cost what the interest rate is on your plant, it can be a payback of 3 years to 6 years, depending on whether you get inexpensive money, let's say at 8%, or if you have to pay 12 or 15% money.
Another objection is that solar technology, whether voltaic or thermal, is only good as long as the sun shines.
Now, with solar thermal technologies, which is quite different from other technologies such as photovoltaics, it's very easy to locate a boiler that burns any other material, such as biomass, which is a waste corn cobs or some kind of agricultural products or wood or garbage or natural gas or oil or coal, and co-locate a plant that burns those kind of things with a solar plant. Then when the solar is no longer available or you're in a cloudy period in the year, you can burn what you've saved up through the rest of the year. A product such as natural gas is available year-round.
Yet another concern, the wind. The mirrors are so delicately balanced that they can be turned with your fingers. So what happens in a gust of wind or with forecasts for strong winds? Rogers says the whole collector is positioned facing south so that it is feathered for east-west winds. For north and south winds, the mirrors can be feathered into the wind like a Venetian blind, allowing the wind to blow right through. Astoundingly simple. In fact, Rogers says there is a lot that would amaze you.
We've always intended to make our own equipment because that's how the business grew up, from all of the people in the company making all the products. What we've learned in the last few years, though, is that it's much smarter to design equipment that anybody can make all the pieces of. And so we've designed the mirrors to be manufactured by window-making companies. The structural steel is made by companies who make steel building panels because they have the technology that they've had buildings out with nice paint on them. They look good for 50 years. Why should we invent that kind of process? And so we've even come to find ways to use automotive products to make all the drive parts. And so there's no part now we can say in the collector that we have to make ourselves.
The company's goal is to get 10,000 up and running by 1995. 31 have been made to date, most in the research and development stage. 2 are in operation in the United States, 1 in Topeka, Kansas, another in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Another 18 are in operation in Saudi Arabia. Rogers believes that the solar industry is at a stage analogous to the personal computer industry 10 years ago. What happens now depends on the benchmark price of oil. Bill Rogers, president of Power Kinetics Incorporated in Troy, New York. For The Environment Show, and this is Bruce Robertson. And that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed the program. We hope you'll join us next week at this same time. If you know of something happening in your area that you think we ought to know about, or if you have a question about this week's or any week's Environment Show, feel free to drop us a line. It's The Environment Show, WAMC, 318 Central Avenue in Albany, New York, and the zip code is 12206. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. The Environment Show is a production of WAMC. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.